Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
I think what America wants to know, Emily, above all, is how do you get to watch TV for a living? How do you get to be a TV critic? How did this happen to you?
It is a scam that I have pulled off to my satisfaction. But at the same time, the amount of television has grown so substantially that all TV critics do is complain.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Whenever I read an essay by Emily Nussbaum about some new show, I know I've got a lot more TV to watch. Emily brings this incredible level of insight and intelligence to her writing. And at the same time, there's always a quality there that's best described as joy. Emily writes all the time in The New Yorker, but she also has a new book coming out called I Like to Watch, Arguing My Way Through the TV Revolution. It's not just a collection of reviews. What the book does is articulate Emily's unique point of view on the medium. I caught up with Emily Nussbaum last week. I think it's important for people to know that what you set out to be was a scholar of Victorian literature.
Well, the truth is, I roamed around a little bit for a while before that. But it's true that I was in graduate school. I had a plan to write my dissertation on the public woman, the overlapping categories of actress, Jewess, and prostitute. So that's what the world was spared, is that dissertation. I was very obsessed with Daniel Deronda. I had a lot going on.
Now, what kind of TV watcher were you growing up and until this time as a budding academic or would-be academic?
Well, as a kid, I liked to watch TV in the way that a lot of kids did in the 70s when I was a little kid and in the 80s. And I had shows that I loved. I loved MASH. I loved WKRP. I loved Taxi. I loved a lot of sitcoms, actually. Mm-hmm. I remember I used to be very nice for babysitters, so they let me stay up and watch The Love Boat and Fantasy Island when that was the big—
Hot stuff.
Yes. And actually, it did seem really perverted.
Kind of hot, like Love American Style in a slightly earlier day.
That was fantastic.
Oh,
I have
man.
A great fondness for Love American Style. And also for, there was actually an Aftermath version of that called Undressed on MTV. So if anyone's listening and they remember Undressed,
I
it was an
that.
Amazing show.
I'm
that
gonna
had,
head for the archives.
Yeah. I like, you know, it's one of the things about TV was that it had, I think, it was both clean and mass culture-ish, and it had this titillating, slightly dirty candy element
but
to it.
But TV criticism growing up, at least in my memory, especially in some place like the New York Times, was that television was essentially, as my parents used to call it, the idiot box, except there was this thing called PBS. There was this, you know, quality, you know, classical music concerts, British television series based on Dickens or Trollope or Austen or something like that.
There was that. Do you remember that Saturday Night Live skit
where
it was like Tales of Ribaldry?
With, yeah. And so you would read these very stern, unfun columns of TV criticism.
Well, a sense of shame hovered over the entire industry that I think afflicted the ability of people to respond to it as critics because it wasn't taken seriously. It was something that people were embarrassed about. And that included people who loved television. But the main way of praising a television show was saying it wasn't like television, that it was more like a book, that it was more like a movie.
Something happened. I mean, I like to watch your one of the great funny, dirty titles of any book. It's just fantastic. But I like to watch in some measure is about individual shows, but it's also about what's now commonly called the golden age of television. So what happened to set that off? A lot of people will say, well, The Sopranos happened. That was the singular tripwire event. You're saying, hold on a minute.
Well, I love The Sopranos. I think The Sopranos is a brilliant television show. But I think that one of the ways in which The Sopranos was praised has to do with this attitude toward television. When people praised The Sopranos, and when people talked about HBO, whose slogan was, it's not TV, it's HBO, it was a way of praising something as transcending television. And I was watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer at the same time as I was watching The Sopranos. I love that show equally. It doesn't look very good, especially at the beginning. It was made in a very TV way, visually. It didn't look like a movie. It has these formulaic structures. It's four acts. It's broken up by commercials. And it's about a teenage girl who has these special powers to fight the forces of darkness. But it's essentially a myth. It's a beautiful, expansive fairy tale myth with a dark side that's about sex and mortality and feminism and, to me, these very substantive issues. And I think it's a very aesthetically ambitious show. But it is hard to talk about in that way, or at least it was when it first came out. The language to talk about The Sopranos was there, and I feel like it magnetized a lot of attention in a way that made it harder for people to talk about the wide range of TV, to talk about comedy, to talk about network TV, to talk about soap opera-like things. There were all of these embedded, hierarchical, class-based biases.
Now, one of the distinguishing features you say in your book, not just implicitly but explicitly, is that The Sopranos is essentially a male-centered show, and that there was a gender prejudice at work here when you're making a distinction between quality, non-quality, Sopranos, Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
The gender prejudice is a big part of it, and that's definitely a factor in what I'm saying, but it's not the whole thing. What I'm talking about is a set of qualities that people reflexively praise versus a set of qualities that people reflexively condescend to. And some of the qualities that The Sopranos had were that it was cinematic. It seemed like a movie rather than TV. That it was about violence rather than sex, so it made it seem substantive. That it was about a middle-aged man who seemed like a character that was a weighty character with gravitas. And that it was made by a singular creator, which made it seem auteurist.
But I could almost hear that auteur,
yeah.
David Chase, leaping through the microphone to say, well, wait a minute, it was also, it was a very capacious show, as many seasons and many hours long, and a lot of the characters who were the most interesting were women.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Look, my problem is not with The Sopranos. It absolutely has fantastic
characters.
It's
the diminishing of the other things.
It's the diminishing of other things.
Right.
It's the way that the gravity of The Sopranos, the magnetism of The Sopranos, essentially blotted out other shows.
So one of the big themes, both in this book and certainly in this golden age of television, is the rise of the antihero. That's a big figure and set of figures in television. What is the lineage of it, and where did it go?
Well, I mean, a lot of people would talk about the original antihero on television, or the most significant antihero, as Tony Soprano. I actually have a piece in my book that talks about Archie Bunker. And it talks about Norman Lear, who's this huge hero to me and big influence on me. But it also talks about something pretty complicated about All in the Family, which was one of the most popular shows. I mean, it was the most popular show in the country, and people loved Archie Bunker, who was a bigot, who was also lovable, who was complicated and funny, and split the audience in half in terms of their responses to him.
Who are the key anti-hero figures of the Golden Age?
Obviously, people talk about Tony Soprano as an anti-hero, Walter White on Breaking Bad,
sure.
And Don Draper. I think that's all true. And I think that those shows, which formed these kind of volumes about masculinity that came out starting around the turn of the century, are this extremely significant change on TV. And one of the things they did that previous TV hadn't been able to do is put this central character on TV that simultaneously attracted and alienated people.
Is it an all-male category?
No. I wrote a whole piece about how Carrie Bradshaw on Sex and the City is actually an unclaimed antihero. I actually feel like she as a character was designed to have a very similar effect on the audience that I feel like viewers often reacted with this mixture of identification and distress at her behavior. But one of the things that those shows did is they smashed open the door for the kinds of characters that could disgust and confuse audiences in ways that were artistically meaningful. And for women especially, like, there have been a million different characters in the aftermath that are also characters that behave poorly but are terrifically charismatic. Fleabag is a recent show that has a character who behaves like a complete jerk in many ways, is also extremely lovable and fascinating, and her charisma is destabilizing to audiences. But she's just one example. The last few years have marked a huge level of just improved inclusiveness in the kind of stories that got told on TV. This is exciting.
And inclusiveness of those who are making it.
Yeah. A lot of the best shows of the last few years have just been straightforwardly made by women and people of color. I mean, that's...
Who would be exemplary of this?
For me, the breakthrough year, I always say this, was there was this year on ABC when Shonda Rhimes, Kenya Barris, and John Ridley were all making television shows. They're all African-American creators, and their shows, Scandal, Black-ish, and American Crime, this very serious drama, could not have been more different from one another. And so none of them had to be the black showrunner on right. ABC. To me, that's the ideal.
Carry the weight of everything.
Yeah, carry the weight of the whole thing. So that's the ideal.
I'm talking with Emily Nussbaum, the New Yorker's television critic, and she's just published a book called I Like to Watch, Arguing My Way Through the TV Revolution. Now, Emily, what else set off what's now considered the golden age? What's the role of technology in this, for example?
Okay. To me, a lot of what happened since the turn of the century in terms of the changes in TV has to do with things like DVRs. Suddenly, TV, which had originally been something that would just sort of extrude into your living room like cookie dough and then disappear. It was a disposable, superficially live thing, even though it was taped. It was a text that you could save, rewind, and share with people. You could pause it. People don't even remember this, but it was a radical change. It basically meant that you could make shows that had a certain kind of visual beauty or density, needed to be decoded, needed to be revisited. You couldn't do that before. Before that, when you created TV, it had to be extremely simple. People had to know what they were looking at immediately. It couldn't bore or confuse you. It couldn't upset you enough to turn it off. Like, it actually had to have certain simple qualities. Once the technology changed, it could expand in its ambition in really remarkable ways. Shows could get slower, faster. Cable changed things, and then the internet. There would not be modern television in the way there is without the internet.
Because?
Because it changed the way the audience interacted with shows. I mean, to me, one of the things I love the most about TV is the unique relationship that it has with the audience. And I say this as a fan of a show.
Well, like, you were in on this really early. You were involved with something called Television Without Pity. What was that?
Television Without Pity was this batshit site filled with threads on every television show imaginable, from The West Wing and Buffy to a lot of reality shows. It began as a site because there were a group of people online who watched Dawson's Creek and were perpetually frustrated that it was such a bad show and it sort of that it should be better, but they were passionate hate watchers. And from that grew this enormous site. And it had people from Hollywood, it had journalists, it had all sorts of regular TV watchers. And 24 hours a day, it was people yammering about shows in enormously granular and Talmudic ways. Like just, you know, threads about hating things, threads about loving things, different relationships. When I was in graduate school, I was on Television Without Pity all the time. And to me, this was actually the basis for my idea of television criticism. Television criticism as a passionate argument, television criticism as something related to fanhood. Even if it was being critical of a show, there was a kind of emotional attachment and a kind of freewheeling gonzo voice. It was great.
Was there a critic model for you? I know you get compared a lot, and it's hardly an insult to Pauline Kael, and probably that's because you're a woman, you write for The New Yorker, there's a very personal, direct mode of address that both writers take on. I think you don't completely love the analogy, though.
I have no problem with the analogy. I mean, it is a compliment. People love
it.
And I see the things that we have in common. The only thing I always say in response is there are a lot of TV critics I know who came from a background in writing about movies. I did not. I came to writing about TV because I love TV. I don't have a film studies background. And when I was growing up, I occasionally read The New Yorker, so I probably read her reviews, but I'm not someone who was directly influenced by her. If I named writers that I was directly influenced by, they're often not arts critics.
Who would they be?
Grace Paley. I read Grace Paley very aggressively, and I loved the specificity and strangeness of her voice. I loved Nora Ephron. When I was in college, I read Mary Gaitskill. It's funny, I'm always asked to name, I mean, there are critics right. that I love, but I was not planning to write criticism. It seemed mean. So I was trying to avoid it, but obviously I failed or became meaner.
Now, you feel that you're in conversation all the time with all the various people writing about television and also the internet itself. You tweet a lot.
Yes.
You have a very strong social media presence, as I do not. And I wonder how that's nourishing, irritating, just what role it plays in your writing.
I think everyone knows the downsides of Twitter. It's
right.
definitely a strange way to communicate. On the other hand, as a television critic, it's been definitely joyful and nourishing. I mean, one of the main things about Twitter is that it gives me access to a global television audience. And every few months, I just say, what's out there that I haven't noticed that's really good?
And it just pours in.
It just pours in, and I put it on a list, and I try to catch things. And so I end up seeing shows like Please Like Me, which is this wonderful Australian half-hour show by this guy, Josh Thomas. This is humane, funny mixture of comedy and drama. He's this young gay guy, and it has this unusual sense of humor and unusual treatment of mental illness. It's an Australian show. I would never have really caught up with it unless people had mentioned it to me. So part of the way I use the internet is trying to break out of my own bubble. So it's not just the shows that the people that I know in person or at The New Yorker are talking about.
Emily, you have a busy life. You write. You watch tons of television. You have a couple of kids. You used to have a life in which you read 900-page Victorian novels, serious literature. Is reading, serious reading, steady reading, getting squeezed out too much of the lives of people? How do you feel about that?
I mean, I wish I had more time to read. I mean, these discussions about anxiety about what's taking over people's attention span are just recurrent. And I can't make a big statement about that. I mean, I love reading novels and I love watching good television shows. And it just doesn't seem fruitful for me to compare the value of them. All I can say is that there are television shows that I've watched that have had the same kind of weight and depth for me as anything that I've ever read.
Emily Nussbaum, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Emily Nussbaum's new book is called I Like to Watch, Arguing My Way Through the TV Revolution. You can read everything she writes for us at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and when we return in a minute, we'll take a trip to the border with Valeria Luiselli. That's ahead.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The debate over the border with Mexico and the whole vexed question of immigration is at the very center of American politics, and it has been ever since the election of Donald Trump. The president continues to stoke the fear of immigration as an existential threat to the country. Meanwhile, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez recently used the term concentration camp to describe the conditions that some migrants are kept in, causing a furor in both parties. Valeria Luiselli is a writer who was born in Mexico and now lives in the U.S. Both her fiction and nonfiction are concerned with the border, and recently she traveled to the region and visited two former mining towns, Tombstone, Arizona, and Shakespeare, New Mexico. Both have had a strange kind of afterlife as stage sets for reenactments of the old Wild West, scenes like the famous gunfight at the OK Corral. Louis Saley wanted to explore how the stories that we tell about the Old West shape our perception of the border, even now.
So the first time I visited Shakespeare and Tombstone was in 2014, right when the immigration crisis started. I returned to both towns this year with my friend Pike Malinowski, a writer and audio documentarian.
1, 2, 1, 2. Testing.
Since my last trip to the Southwest, things have gotten really bad. The national fixation on the border crisis has reached a fever pitch, and the way that undocumented migrants are treated at the border has hit record lows. It's a good moment to return to the borderlands and think about the ways that the legends of the Wild West and their reenactments coexist or clash with the actual reality surrounding these towns. Pike and I meet in Tucson in late April. Our first stop is with our two local friends, Francisco Cantu and Karima Walker. Oh, there's Karima. Hey, Karima.
Hi.
We want to pick their brains a bit about the towns we're going to visit the next day.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Very good.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Does anybody want a beer?
I would love a mezcalito.
Okay.
They live in a small adobe house full of books and plants. We sit around the kitchen table. Francisco was a Border Patrol agent for a few years, and he wrote a book about the experience called The Line Becomes a River.
Yeah, I worked for the Border Patrol for 3.5 years, from 2008 until 2012. I think the most harmful part of the narrative is this narrative that the people that you're encountering are criminals, right? It's this narrative of criminality. When you're at the academy, you're like, all these encounters that you have like pose a danger to you, and like the first primary preoccupation from the beginning of an interaction until the end of an interaction is like your safety as a good guy versus this bad guy, you know? But I think like the huge gulf in that narrative is that most of these encounters, like, they're not criminal encounters. I mean, the vast majority are humanitarian encounters, right? Like, these are encounters with refugees, not criminals, most of the time.
We're grateful and somewhat relieved that Francisco has agreed to come with us to Tombstone tomorrow. As a Mexican and as a woman, I'm a bit nervous about driving into these towns and being so close to the border.
Get a walk.
Early next morning, the sun is already strong.
Valeria, do you want like a baseball hat or like a little fedora hat or a cowboy hat?
The Stetson.
You want to wear a fucking Stetson?
Yeah, let me see it. You think I'll pass?
Here's my mom.
We set out for Tombstone. Francisco at the wheel and Pike recording in the back seat. We're going to talk to reenactors at the OK Corral. It's the most famous reenactment in town and features some legendary Wild West characters like Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp.
I don't know if it's still around, I doubt it.
We're driving deeper into the desert. Outside the car window, saguaros, creosote, ocotillo, and mesquite. The jagged peaks of the Dragoon Mountains to the east, and further than that, the tall peaks of the mighty Chiricahua Mountains. Driving into Tombstone feels like entering the set of an old western. The streets are lined with saloons, little museums. There's an old brothel and many souvenir shops. Horse-drawn stage coaches pass by constantly.
Here comes a reenactor. Can we talk to you for a
work? Real quick, though, because I'm on my way into work, so.
Who are you?
Today I'm playing Frank McClowry. Very, very bad man. The only one who really knew what he was doing on the cowboy side in the gunfight.
His name is Zach Eder. He's spaghetti-bodied, walks with a joyful kind of skip, and is visibly enjoying every one of the deep puffs he takes of his cigarette.
There's nothing quite like getting to shoot guns at your friends all day and then getting up and going to have a beer after you're done, you know, like.
The OK Corral reenactment recreates a dispute leading to a 30-second shootout between outlaw cowboys and lawmen.
My name is Virgil Earp. I am town marshal of Tombstone. I lay down the law.
The reenactor's name is David Moore, and he has a major in history.
Recently, there was an ordinance passed that prohibits carrying a gun in town. Now, I heard those cowboys are carrying guns in town today. And if they don't render those guns peacefully, we will take those guns away by force if necessary, and the rest will be history.
The line that divides performance and reality seems a little thin in Tombstone. We ask him what it is that draws so many people to these old Wild West shows.
I think deep down, a lot of people, you know, they search and wish for a simpler time. Yeah, I think that's why.
First show of the day, folks, right here at the OK Corral, here at 11 a.m. Come get your tickets now right through these red doors.
We walk into a walled, rectangular area. Dirt floor, some barrels, haystacks, a recreation of old storefronts on one end, and metal bleachers on the other end.
Darling.
Hi, darling.
Here's how it's going to work. I'm going to let you get in there. I'm going to let you have a seat, but don't get up, give me no trouble. You give me any trouble, I might have to use this guy for target practice. I don't know.
All right.
But I need lots of practice. I've had a lot of drink today.
All right.
But don't worry, it's always safety first at the OK Corral. That's right, I left my bottle at the bar. You'll be safe.
All right.
Get in there.
Thank you.
We find a seat among 20 or 30 spectators.
Are you folks ready for a gunfight?
Now I said, are you folks ready for a gunfight?
All right. Now, before we get started today, I do have to talk to you about a couple things. First things first, folks, these are not toys. They are real firearms.
Doc Holliday gives us instructions.
Do not attempt to pull them from our holsters at any time. Do not ask us to hold them to your spouse's head for pictures. It's not going to happen.
There's a good versus bad logic in the reenactment.
The good guys are the gentlemen dressed like me wearing ties around their necks.
The Earps are the good guys.
I want you to cheer them.
The Clantons, part of the group called the Cowboys, are the bad guys.
Likewise, when you see those dirty, smelly cowboys walk through those doors, I want you to boo them.
Not much room here for nuance or ambiguity.
Let's give it a try right now. Good guys.
Yeah.
Bad guys.
Woo.
Good guys.
Yeah.
Are you folks ready for a gunfight?
Yeah.
Are you ready for a killing?
Up your hands, boys. We're here for your guns. Oh, I don't want that. Oh, no. Wait. I don't got a gun.
All right, Lummer.
One of the narratives in the OK Corral reenactment is that of vigilante justice. Civilians who deputize themselves in order to perform the tasks normally reserved for law enforcement.
I got one left for you!
You get away, let me die!
Well, that was it. Over before it ever started.
After the show, we walk around town for a while talking to people, trying to learn more about the history.
Who are interesting people to talk to in town? Who are like people that have a memory of town, good stories
well,
about?
Well, if you can get a hold of them, that's the hard part. The best person to talk to about town is a fellow by the name of Ben Trawick.
Ben Trawick?
Yeah. Go down two streets, you turn left at the Crystal Palace, across from the Epitaph Newspaper Museum is a two-story adobe. The man who lives there is Ben Trawick. And he has a bookstore downstairs that he opens when he feels like it because he's 93 years old. But he's still clear in his head, and he got here back in the 60s, and he loves the town.
We find Ben Trawick's bookstore in a side street.
Hi.
Hello there.
Hi, are you Mr. Ben Trawick?
And we enter a cluttered, dark space.
Ben Trawick.
Oh, I'm sorry. We were just talking to someone that told us that you were a town historian.
There's books, magazines, and documents all piled up in columns.
Do what?
For a long time, you acted as a town historian.
And in the left-hand corner of the shop, there's this old man with a snowy mustache and some strands of white hair.
Yeah, 42 years, but I retired 3 years ago.
He's bending over a manuscript.
We were wondering if we could speak to you, like a brief interview.
What are you going to do with it?
We ask him about the history of the reenactment scene in Tombstone. And it turns out he's kind of like a local Wizard of Oz.
Well, when I came here in 1968, I saw that Tombstone was not being advertised. That's the key right there, advertisement. So I wrote a script, and we decided to do historical acts.
Trawick apparently wrote the original OK Corral reenactment and played Wyatt Earp for 20 years.
The women did hanging groups, comic things, you know, and we did serious things.
His bookstore is full of objects. There's a Confederate flag in the back, some Mayan masks and relics behind his desk, a few dusty mariachi hats. many framed pictures of admirals and generals. He points to the door.
Move that door to a little bit and look at the picture behind it on the wall. That's Nathan Bedford Forrest. He's the greatest cavalry leader ever been.
Nathan Bedford Forrest was a Confederate Army general during the American Civil War and was elected the first Grand Wizard of the KKK.
Now, I had two great-grandfathers who was in his 2nd Cavalry Unit. One was a sergeant, the other got killed in Kentucky.
And you have a book about the Ku Klux Klan as well.
Yeah, I wrote that in self-defense. They lied so much about that that I got sick of hearing it.
What were some of the lies about the Klan that you took care of?
Well, one of them was that, about how they treated slaves.
In the book, he says that those who understand the KKK view it as a beloved symbol of all that is holy and beautiful.
I hate to see something wrong in history.
I went to ask him about historical accuracy. Seems like there are no Mexican or Native American characters in any of the reenactments.
Mexicans were part of the civilization we had here.
Yeah. But are they, like, you know, we have like a lot of Doc Holliday's, Wyatt Earp, the Clantons in the reenactments. Are there any reenactments in town where there's a role that a Mexican, not a Mexican actor, but that the character is Mexican?
Well, it's hard to say. You have to take them as a whole, you know. In our show, we had a Mexican in our group. He cooked the best beef in the world.
But the guy was Mexican.
Yeah.
I'm talking about people that are now part of a reenactment show.
No, some of them are politicians. A lot of them own stores.
I'm curious to ask him about his views on Mexico-U.S. relations more generally.
Do you think there should be a wall dividing Mexico and the U.S.? Or
I think that they made a big mistake when they got Santa Ana and had a chance to. They should have annexed Mexico and let them keep all the states they had, let them run them, but be under the United States or with the United States.
Part of the United States.
That would solidify the whole continent, mm-hmm. of North America.
Mm. Including Central America?
Yeah, I would care to get them too.
And now, well, okay, that said, but that didn't happen. So do you think there should be a wall between Mexico and the U.S.?
Yeah, I do. I do because we have gotten so many criminals and so many people with diseases that we need to protect ourselves.
Have you had any real life experience with what you're talking about now, like criminals or people with diseases here?
Well, when people come to town here, they're illegal. They know that the people in town know they're illegal. It's a small town. They get a cold drink and hit for the big city where they can disappear. Well, none of them stay here. We don't have any in town right now that I know of. They also know that everybody in town's got a gun.
Vigilantism in Tombstone goes beyond everyone carrying guns, though. The organized vigilante group, the Minutemen, was created in Tombstone in 2002. Chris Simcox, then the editor of the Tombstone Tumbleweed, put out a call to arms. Citizens Border Patrol Militia now forming. Concerned citizens join together to protect your country in a time of war.
Well, I also heard about, you know, that the Minutemen started here, and there was kind of, do you know anything about that?
No.
No.
Trewick is hesitant to talk about the relationship between Tombstone, the Minutemen, and Chris Simcox, but I push a little further.
The owner of the newspaper, the Tumbleweed, he was part of the Minutemen, right?
Yeah, he was, but it had nothing to do with the rest of the people. That was his own project.
A few years after his call to arms, Simcox had about 900 armed volunteers patrolling the border, and he was praised by people like Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Well, he was a good historian, and he was a good newspaper man. When he started that, it looked like a good thing, but he let it take over his life, and he got all out of bounds. I think he finally went to jail, didn't he?
He did. Chris Simcox is serving a 19-year sentence for child molestation. So perhaps it's understandable that people in Tombstone prefer to dissociate themselves. We say goodbye and step back out into the afternoon sun.
Valeria Luiselli in Tombstone, Arizona. Her reporting from the border continues in a minute. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're traveling in the border region of the Southwest today, revisiting the idea of the Wild West with the writer Valeria Luiselli. Luiselli wanted to explore how the history of militias and vigilantes affects how people think about the border even today. She was accompanied by the producer, Pike Malinowski, and their first stop was in Tombstone, Arizona.
The junior ROTC from the local high school is parading down the main street. There's a sense of military preparedness in the air. We walk into a souvenir store that sells T-shirts. There's one with two guns forming an X and the words, Second Amendment, the original Homeland Security.
The original Homeland Security, Tombstone, Arizona? What does it mean? Who was the original Homeland Security?
Guns.
Oh, okay, because it's the two guns.
Yeah,
right.
The two guns. Oh. Yeah, that was our security back in the day. That's all they had. There was not a lot of law and order around.
Right.
It's confusing and hard for us to process all of this. The laughters and fun-driven entertainment of the reenactments.
Are you folks ready for a gunfight?
Yeah!
Are you ready for a killing?
Yeah!
The love of guns, the beauty of the surrounding desert, the welcoming smiles and openness to conversation of many of the Tombstone residents, and then their feelings about immigrants. There are many questions spinning in our heads as we drive out. Which founding myths are being played out here? And what sentiments do they activate in people? Back in the car, our friend Francisco tells us about the relationship between the institution of the Border Patrol and the myth of the frontier. That is, the idea of a place at the very edge of civilization which needs to be conquered and tamed.
The performance element of it, right? You know, like, you know, you're in the Border Patrol, and yes, it's a very, it's like a serious job, and there are times when it means life or death, but, like, it's also, at the same time, like a performance, right? And people are joining, and they're imagining that they're on this frontier outpost, you know, like, as this, you know, as representatives of this civilization, that is sort of in conflict or that has to be asserted against the other, right? And it's just, to me, as I'm in this place, like the what separates that kind of a performance, you know, in the context of law enforcement from, like, these people dressing up as cowboys, like, I see less and less that separates them, you know? Like, the separation is sort of, like, dissolving as I'm, like, walking through this space.
Our next stop is Shakespeare, a ghost of a ghost town in southern New Mexico.
I'm Rod Linkus, by the way.
Hi. Rod Linkus is a retired reenactor from El Paso and now gives tours of Shakespeare.
Just watch where you step. Everything in the Southwest either sticks, bites, scratches, stings, or poisons you.
The town was once a mining town. Then it became a ghost town, and for a while there were reenactments and rehearsals of gunfights and hangings there. But now it's only open for walking tours. The town consists only of a few abandoned buildings and a spindly aluminum windmill.
Well, the only water we got is the windmill there.
The Shakespeare webpage warns visitors of rattlesnakes, mine borings and shafts, as well as, quote, the current danger of drug mules walking from the southern border.
There have been reports of drug mules coming from over that way, up across the cemetery, down and in the arroyo back behind here, and down to the highway.
How do we know there are drug mules or
evidence? Things left behind, tracks, right. Stuff like that.
But they could also be migrants with.
Well, both. There's both here. Yeah.
Right.
Coyotes and the mules. Just depends on what day and what time. Matter of fact, a couple of months ago, they stopped 360 illegals crossing the border, and an hour later captured 140 bringing marijuana across, about 5 miles away.
Right. And who caught them? Border Patrol?
Border Patrol, yeah. Border Patrol.
Because sometimes there's also, what are they called, like organized civilian...
Yeah, the militias.
The militias?
They've been kicked out because I've... You know, politics, basically, but they've never threatened anybody. All they can do is detain them until the Border Patrol gets there. Mm. So they're doing a job. Any one day, there's 4,000 Border Patrol agents to cover 6,000 miles of territory, Canadian and Mexican border.
Right.
So that's not a whole lot. So I can see them trying to help some way.
Civilian border militia, or vigilantes, are not a new trend in the borderlands. They emerged in the late 19th century after the war between Mexico and the U.S., when Mexico lost half its territory and the new border between the two countries was being drawn. Shakespeare had its own vigilantes.
Shakespeare, little town of anywhere from 200 or 300 up to 3,000 people, was never attacked by the Apaches. We did have a guard here called the Shakespeare Guard. I guess you would call it a vigilante group. And they actually did chase Victorio at one time. Didn't capture him. They were lucky, probably. They were given surplus military weapons and ammunition, and they actually trained like a military unit.
Vigilantes fought native peoples, like the Apaches, as enemies. Today, militia perceive undocumented immigrants, many of them also native people, as enemies to be fought. An enemy who is not fighting back, who just wants a better life. When we leave Shakespeare, we decide to drive down to the border. In Douglas, Arizona, we reach the wall, a part of the wall that was constructed during the Obama administration. There are two walls, in fact, one painted creamy white on the American side, the other copper-colored on the Mexican side, with a strip of land the width of about 10 long strides between the two of them.
Pues he mirado a que hasta se cruzan por aquí mismo por las puertas también.
We meet a Mexican man, Guadalupe, who's walking back into Mexico from a long day's work. He's carrying a big hammer in his hand. I ask him what he thinks about the wall.
¿Tienes la idea de un wall del muro este?
Pues así hagan lo que hagan, esto no va a parar. La gente la va a buscar muchas formas.
Whatever they do, people are gonna find a way around. Yeah. Pues sí, sí, si hay que trabajar, hay que trabajar.
Guadalupe got a green card years ago, and he works in the U.S. because he makes 10 times more working here than he would in Mexico. We drive west along the wall until we see a sign for an RV park called Twin Buttes. We're curious to talk to people who live so close to the border. You can see the wall from here.
Oh, there's someone.
Oh, yeah.
A woman named Beverly greets us with a neighborly smile.
Hi.
How's
Hi.
It going?
Good.
Hey.
Hi.
Good to help you. We're working on a story, a documentary about the border, and we were wondering if you wanted to talk to us.
I can.
Yeah?
Sure. Yeah. My husband might want to also.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why does he...
Oh, he really
that.
Keeps up on all that stuff, yeah. Uh-huh.
Is he around, too?
Yeah, he is. If you want to walk around that way, I'll meet you out the back door.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Out back, There are four men and one woman sitting at a long wooden picnic table. They're sipping beers.
Hi, kids.
Hello.
Hi, how are
you? How y'all doing?
Very good.
What can we do for you? You guys aren't from America.
Oh, not originally. I'm a U.S. citizen, but I'm originally from Denmark.
Okay, the accent. Okay, yeah, I recognize it right off.
That's Roger Kircher, definitely the alpha male of the group. He bought the RV park in 2002.
From 02 until 08, in the middle of the night, we would have 20 people at our front door at 2 o'clock in the morning. Looking for help.
And a ride to Phoenix.
Yeah.
Everybody wanted a ride to Phoenix.
Drinking out of the cattle tank and filling up their water jugs to go on through the desert.
Roger has first-hand experience in helping deport people. He tells us about a Guatemalan man that had already been deported three times and tried to cross once more.
And I sent him back the fourth time because I have a Border Patrol agent who lives in that trailer and I have a very good friend that's a customs agent.
Do you see militias here?
I was here during the Minutemen militia, and I used to drive by to make sure that they had plenty of water. Now, they had guns. They can't pull a gun on anybody, or they go to jail. That's our law. But they can sit in their truck in the back end with binoculars and spot illegals coming across, and then radio call in to the Border Patrol.
The sun is setting, and the sky above the RV park is vast and cloudless.
Whatever possessed you guys to start this little documentary thing about the border?
Well, it's a big issue right now. And yeah.
He also wants to know where we live. And we tell him we're both based in New York.
Is that in the U.S.? We're not sure it still exists. We're going to annex that one, you know what I mean? When the wall comes up, we're going to go right on the East Coast and the West Coast. Just leave the middle as the United States because we seem to have more common sense than the East Coast and the West Coast people do.
So a solid wall all the way and
would be a good start.
And change the laws.
And like the Guatemalan that's been set back, I sent him back the fourth time, then he's going to go to prison. And he's going to spend some time because we took him back to Mexico and he came back and he got caught. And then he came back and he got caught. And then I caught him and he went, there's no penalty for breaking our laws. All right, well, you know, let's go with your piles. Let's put them on a chain gang and let them cut the road ditches and teach you a lesson that, listen, we're seriously, get the right documentation and we'll welcome you into our United States of America. But don't break in. You don't break into anybody's house.
Pike and I look at each other. We take a deep breath. And without really saying anything to each other, we know it's maybe time to go.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
No. You got to come and follow me for 5 minutes. I know you're in a hurry.
Yeah, we have to go to Bisbee before sunset. But
before sunset, yeah.
Really? Why?
Because we're excited to see it.
Then Roger shows us his golf cart. It has a blue siren light stuck to the top and a bumper sticker that says, Tombstone, Arizona. Justice is coming.
I'm like the local sheriff for Twin Buttes RV Park. I got the blue light, and it lights up, and people, they make me the sheriff around here because I'm the law and order. I make the rules.
He reaches into the glove box of the golf cart and takes out a pistol.
I never leave home without one. We live in a dangerous area. One in my cars, one in my golf cart.
Are you folks ready for a gunfight?
Yeah.
Are you ready for a killing?
Yeah.
I came to Tombstone and Shakespeare trying to step outside my usual dynamics, trying to understand the current crisis from a different angle. Wild West reenactments and the myths that fuel them, like the frontier myth and the idea of vigilante justice, did shed some light on the emotions driving the responses to the border crisis. And the other way around, too. Thinking about civilian border patrolling explained some of the myths behind reenactment culture. As we drive away, further from the border, I feel uneasy and maybe a little hopeless. What possibility of dialogue is there when people's opinions are so divided? But back in Tucson late that night, we meet someone with a much more optimistic outlook.
I love my work because that's the way to promote Tucson, the city, my country, the United States in Mexico also.
His name is Pablo Martinez, and he's an Uber driver.
I have a lot of happiness serving everybody.
When we ask Pablo Martinez where he's from, he smiles really wide and says, I'm from Tucson, Mexico.
We cannot be fighting like animals, you know, or hating. Hating is from evil. You know, we cannot have that. We can, you know, put the love in front. That's the values that God give us. And if they said that this is land from, you know, that respect God, okay, let's build it up. Uh-huh. We are here to build. We're not here to destroy.
Valeria Luiselli, traveling in the Southwest along with Pike Malinowski, who produced our story. You can find Valeria's article, The Wild West Meets the Southern Border, at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for today. Next week, we'll hear from Aaron Sorkin, whose new play based on To Kill a Mockingbird is one of Broadway's biggest hits this year. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for listening.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Andres O'Hara, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Meng Fei Chen and Emily Mann. Karima Walker contributed additional sound design. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.